This is Tax Chats. Hello, I'm Scott Dyring.
And I am Jeff Hoops.
And we're here to chat
about taxes.
Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Tax Chats. I'm Scott Dyring, professor of accounting at Duke University, and I am joined, as always, by my friend and colleague and co-host at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and sitting in the Tax Museum, Jeffrey L. Hoops. Jeffrey L. Hoops. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello.
I don't know why I couldn't get out that very difficult to pronounce last name. It might be a fear of pronouncing the last name of our guest, but I'll let you do that. So what are we doing today?
So we have with us Wojciech Kopczyk. Wojciech, you want to introduce yourself a little bit?
Hi. Thanks for inviting me. I'm Wojciech Kopczyk. I'm a professor at Columbia University. I work on public finance, including inequality, some work on inequality. And I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, so we're talking today about income inequality. So do you want to just start out telling us what we mean when we say income inequality? Like, what does that actually mean?
That's a loaded question right to begin, right there. But yeah.
That is a very loaded question. What it means is that we should have some concept of what income is, which I'm sure that we'll come back to. What is income? And it's unequally distributed in the society. And we want to document exactly how that distribution looks like, which means making a lot of decisions about, as I said, what is income? How can we observe it? What we include, what we don't include? Who do we count? And so on.
Do you think it's worth right here at the outset drawing a distinction between income inequality and wealth inequality?
Income is what accrues over the course of a year and that we chose to count. And wealth is, at least as defined in this literature, is usual as something like net worth of individuals. So you can sort of think about it as the distinction between flow and stock.
Flow and stock, or as if you're an accountant, you might think of it as the income statement versus the balance sheet.
and this difference can be a huge deal. Where for a given person in 1 year. I think about it very differently. If somebody who's like run a successful plumbing business sells it at age 65 for $1.5 million, but the whole rest of her life didn't make all that much, whereas like a hedge fund manager might make $1.5 million a single year. In that 1 year, their incomes will be the same, but they could have vastly different wealth. And you should think about those two people very, very differently. Now, the tax system currently doesn't really think about those two people differently, but we should think about them differently. At least I think we should.
Yes, and that immediately goes into one of the methodological problems, which is how do you define income? So we want to think about something like annual measure, and given that you invited me, and I presume we want to talk about top incomes, the best source of information that you have to rely on is tax returns. And tax returns are mostly based on realization concept of income. So, things like capital gains are included, and things like, retained earnings within a business would not necessarily be showing up on the individual income tax returns. And there are various issues related to retirement income that we may come back to. This distinction matters a lot. Methodologically, sort of if you look at the first big paper in this literature was 2003 Piketty and Sayed's paper. I mean, there was earlier work, but really this is like the big paper. And that paper was pretty much just relying on the tax returns, and it was using showing some results with capital gains, some results without capital gains, but basically relying on things that you can observe on individual income tax returns. Since then, there's been a shift to kind of be more cognizant of this realization aspect of incomes and focus on accrual, which means not looking at capital gains and instead trying to come up with accrual measures.
So starting in 2002, like, what was the general consensus about the level of income inequality, how it's changed over time? Like, what, you know, there's that paper, there are other papers. Hell, I kind of don't understand why we can publish so many papers that seem to say the exact same thing. But what do we generally believe about income inequality as far as its level and how it's changed?
No, the history, like, let's even go back slightly, very, very quickly, slightly back. So the history of all of this is that, I mean, like, economists used to be interested in inequality long ago, like before World War II, or then some of Kuznets' work was published like in the late 40s. So there was a lot of interest, some interest in inequality when inequality was high. And then there were decades where economists didn't really pay much attention to inequality, and that sort of started changing in the 1980s when you had literature that was sort of, you know, thinking about differences between college graduates and high school graduates and blue versus white collar workers, or 80th versus 20th percentile, and was documenting sort of rising wage inequality around that time. So, you know, it seemed like something was happening in the 80s and beyond, or maybe starting in the 70s in terms of earnings. But that was sort of, you know, broader picture of inequality. That wasn't the focus on the top 1%. And then I think, you know, in the 90s, people sort of realized that maybe something has shifted in terms of top incomes. There was some work by Finberg and Poterba. There was literature on compensation of CEOs and so on. So there was maybe a bit more attention to what's happening at the top. And then Piketty and Saez came in. First Piketty with a French paper, and then Piketty and Saez with their joint paper in the US. That what they've done was basically they revisited old tax return information from various publications of the IRS that tabulations going back to really the beginning of the income tax, 1913. And then sort of as you come closer, looking at some survey data and like other pieces of information that and micro data from IRS. So they've done all of this to construct what they called the measures of top 1% and some bigger groups when they could have done it. And basically, the main finding from that work was that inequality was very high before World War II, precipitously dropped very quickly in the aftermath of. Really starting like around 19, well, depends on how you look at it, but like starting in late 30s, maybe during World War II, stayed low and then started going up pretty rapidly in the 70s, but really taking off in the 1980s.
And so if I look at a graph from Piketty and Saez, it'll have a timeline along the bottom. So starting in, say, 1913 all the way up to, say, maybe like 2000 roughly. And it's looking at like the share of income of like the top 1% or even sometimes the top 0.1%. So the very highest. And you would maybe expect them to earn a little bit more. But what they're showing is like in the 1915s or something, the top 0.1% were earning like 12% of the income in the United States. And then it looks like a giant U and it goes down to something like 2% in the maybe 50s and 60s, and then it goes back up to like 6 or 7% in like the year 2000, roughly. That's what you're describing. So people have an idea in their head. You're looking at a big U, and there was a lot of income going to the 0.1%. in like the really early 1900s, and then it got low, and now it's gotten high again, according to Piketty and Saez.
And it's kind of a strong trend that sort of they've been updating their numbers regularly. So like, there's the 2003 paper, but you know, that methodology has been extended going until now, and it's kind of it keeps growing.
And so of course the political ramifications are important. Like if the high income people are just having more and more and more of the total income, that might motivate having a more progressive tax system, increasing tax rates at the very top, or you know, having a wealth tax, or changing the capital gains tax rate to be higher because high-income people were more likely to have capital gains. So there's a lot of political ramifications to this trend upwards.
Yeah, so definitely this is, you know, this is all in the background of all of this. I think you can also... I mean, I haven't done intellectual and media history of this, but I think you can give them credit for the fact that we are using these terms like top 1%. Like that's where it's coming from.
Can you help me understand something else? So sometimes when we think about, okay, there's a share of income, we think of income as sort of like, it's like a zero sum game. And if the top 1% gets a whole bunch of the pie, there's like nothing left for the bottom 1%. And so many people believe that means, therefore, that the bottom 1% has nothing because the top 1% accumulated everything. Does it work like that? Or is it possible that the top 1% can have a whole bunch of income and there could be like just theoretically like no poverty? Like, is there a difference between thinking of income shares and how much poverty there is in the world?
There is definitely a lot of difference between those two things. The distribution and the levels are not necessarily tightly related to each other.
US
is a rich society, even the poorest Americans are much richer than people in very low income countries.
So why do we care if society is very unequal? Like why? So I think it's interesting. They put out these stylized facts. It's a huge amount of attention, huge number of follow-up papers, huge number of citations. What's the downside to being unequal? Is there literature on that? And what do we know about the downsides to inequality?
I think that's a perfect follow-up question, right? Because if there was income inequality and everybody was still like perfectly like had plenty of money, like who cares?
Well, there still might be other, even if everybody has plenty of money, there might be like psychological effects. Like what's the downside?
Well, yeah, I'm curious to hear what Wojciech says. I have my own ideas, but yeah.
What's the downside? It's not obvious that there has to be downside, but there may be downsides. So actually, even before talking about downsides, I think, you know, as an intellectual exercise of documenting something like this, you know, when you have if you have like big trends in how income is distributed, if incomes are growing sort of at different rates at different parts of the distribution, that sort of begs an explanation of what's happening. So having these stylized facts, even if you didn't care about politics, even if you were not worried about downsides and like, you know, social ramifications of all of this, you would still want to know these types of things because these are things that that we kind of want to understand, like what's been happening with the economy, like that. What does it tell us about how the economy has been evolving? And you know, also, it's potentially related to policies. So, what does it tell us about the implications of policy? So, you don't have to go into politics to actually care about what's been happening. What's been happening here? What are the downsides? So potential downsides, I think, you know, one big one that I guess I worry about to some extent is various issues related to power and influence. Influence on the political process, things related to rent seeking, lobbying, like stuff like this. On this one, it's actually not obvious how tightly it is connected to these measures of income inequality or wealth inequality that people look at. But you know, it like these things may be connected with each other.
So by that, I mean, if you have, you know, 10 people who each have $100 billion, they just have too much power. They can buy political power. They can buy votes. They can buy whatever.
Right. But but if this is what you are interested in, I think like what you would want to do is actually think about measures of power. Some ways of documenting that this is exactly what's happening, and it's not that like there's political economy literature that looks into some of this. There is literature on lobbying. There are cross-country correlations that relate measures of inequality with various dysfunctional outcomes. But it's not really like. That's not really the focus of this literature. It's sort of what's in this literature is kind of a presumption that if you have more concentration, then it leads to these bad outcomes.
Just as it needs to be spread out, just because.
If you believe that concentration of income or wealth is related to these negative political or maybe social outcomes, then if there was a tight connection between those, then you could make that leap. That you see higher inequality, therefore. Those things are happening, but like this, therefore, is like documenting that part is.
I mean, I do think it's worth just noting this political power. I said, if you have 10 people, all that have $100 billion each, that's a lot of power for them to have. I mean, I think Larry Summers made the point rightly that if they, let's say, we somehow take half of their wealth away, if they each only have $50 billion, still a lot of money. If we take 90% of their, they still got a lot of money. So we could have way less inequality. But even just having in the tens of millions or hundreds of millions, you can still buy a lot of political influence with very little money.
I mean, I think that's what Wojciech, I think your point was, if I'm not mistaken, that's where the use of income inequality as a proxy for power is probably a little bit noisy.
I can believe that there is some relationship between those two things. Believing that there is one-to-one relationship is
probably not. So I got a second question. I read a long time ago Piketty's book about capital in the 21st century, or I think that's what it's called. It's kind of a very famous book.
You read the book or the introduction? Scott, let's be honest here.
No, actually, I listened to it. I don't ever read books, really. I pretty much listen to them. It was quite a long time ago. But it seemed to me like one of his themes was that income inequality, or I don't remember if he was talking about income or wealth inequality, but inequality can lead to like social unrest and revolutions and wars. Am I remembering that correctly?
I think that was one of the things in the book, and there is a pretty old argument along these lines that you have to. Pre-20th century argument that you have to keep masses somewhat satisfied because otherwise they will go after the ruling elites. So that that kind of political dynamics is like that's not a new argument. Maybe we are not thinking about the world in exactly the same way nowadays, but that backlash doesn't need to take a form of revolution. It can take a. I mean, like Ivan Verning has papers that basically. Talk about capital taxation or kind of provide arguments for optimal taxation of capital that's sort of along these lines, because absent that you have sort of accumulation and then you have backlash.
Okay, so I want to maybe dig a little deeper. Earlier, like when we first started chatting, we said, what is income inequality? And we said, well, we got to first figure out how to define income. And you would think, like, at first glance, if you're not an accountant or an economist who's thought about this, oh, it's just income. Income is easy. But if you're an accountant, you know that defining income is very difficult. And I think in terms of defining income inequality, it can be even more difficult because, I guess I'm hoping you'll tell us some of the reasons, but I think some of the reasons go along the lines of this. Number one, what can we observe in terms of how is your wealth changing. So a change in wealth would typically be income, and at least one way of defining it. But then is it an individual that accrues income? Is it a family? Is it a household? Is it like, what is the unit of observation, and does that matter? And I guess maybe I wonder if you could speak a little bit to some of the complications that arise when one tries to just define income.
Yeah. So Piketty and Sayers used what they call fiscal income, which is basically driven by what you can observe in on individual income tax returns. With or without capital gains, which...
And if they're using tax returns, does that mean they're thinking of a taxpayer as the unit of observation?
They are thinking about what they call, in that original paper, they were thinking about what they call the tax unit, which is sometimes it's a single individual, sometimes it's a married couple, sometimes it's a married couple with dependents. Or a single individual with dependents, which immediately creates a bunch of problems because, first of all, we probably don't care about exactly about tax units. Maybe we care about households. Maybe we care about individuals. But like tax unit is a very, very strange concept.
You've defined your concept just because that's exactly what you measure, which is like an old research trick, right? If you measure something, just say, oh, that's magically what we care about, that exact thing, to maintain construct validity.
But to give them credit, this is from this 20-year-old paper. Like they've done different things since then. So a tax unit is sort of, you know, potentially problematic concept, and it's if you think about like the implications of it. So first of all, it's like not exactly what we care about, but like if it was a stable concept, then maybe, you know, that wouldn't be that bad. But there are changes over time in marital patterns, which, you know, affects like how households look like and what the tax units are on the tax returns. You can start thinking about things like adjusting. Equivalence scale type of adjustments where the same income for a family of one or versus family of five, you know, it's not the same thing.
Or so in on. Jeff's case, a family of seven, or in my case, a family of eight.
Oh, congratulations.
So Jeff
guys.
And I both have many children. You had to make a big adjustment for the Dyrings and the Hoops.
Exactly.
So I guess just to get more explicit there, so if you're counting per person and the average family unit size just is, you know, monotonically decreasing over this time, it's going to change your estimate. And if the number of people isn't changing uniformly across the income distribution, then it really messes things up. If rich people still have to have, or if poor people have more, you know, it gets complicated.
Or alternatively, if marriage rates are changing over time, or if marriage rates change across different demographics in the distribution, or on and on and on and on.
Exactly. Yeah. Even if marriage rates were not changing, like who marries whom, it's changing. So if rich people marry increasingly rich people, you know, that also has implications.
Is that true? Are rich people more likely to marry rich people now than they were 30 years ago? Do we know anything about that?
There is literature on assortative matching. I'm going to punt on this. what the exact pattern is. I think it's true, but I don't think this is like the dominant force for it.
Jeff should know the most important advice he should give to his children, which is you can marry more in a minute than you can make in a lifetime. So just tell your kids that, Jeff.
There you go. I will. I'll do it.
I've told my kids that, but I'm not sure if they'll follow that advice. So I don't know. We'll see. Okay. So just defining the unit of interest is interesting. So, and you said that Piketty and Sayers themselves and many others, of course, have changed from being a tax unit to other things. So I'm assuming people look at household income.
Well, not exactly. So, or it depends. It is really driven by the data that you are using. So papers that use survey data which for top incomes really just means primarily means survey of consumer finances. They would use households because that's the unit of observation there.
And that's like the census or somebody who conducts those?
No, Federal Reserve.
Federal Reserve, okay.
Yeah, like, and you know, the big thing there is that they actually make a big effort to oversample high income and high net worth.
That's why they're always calling Scott.
Then trust me, they never call me. Yeah. Okay. So that's one thing, households. What else have people looked at?
Individuals. That's what newer papers that that use tax data or administrative data try to do, because you don't actually observe households. And then you have to make some decisions about how you split it between the two spouses and like, you know, how much information you have on that and so on. So it's individuals. There are also like small, well, not necessarily small issues, but like who do you include? What about dependents? What about children? So basically, generally, you probably don't want to include children, or maybe you could, but like that's people try to look at adults, but you have college students that are that may be dependents. Like you have various issues along these lines that sort of create some difficulties with the existing data.
So if the initial kind of stylized fact with income inequality is high and increasing, 2002, and then you know many papers after that that confirm that using these different units of definition. Has the thinking about that changed in the last year or so? And if so, what new evidence do we have?
Right. So we need one step back before that. Piketty Sayers used this notion of fiscal income. The problem with fiscal income, sort of things that you see on the individual income tax returns, is that it's not all of the income in the economy, however you unless you define it as fiscal income, the natural, not perfect, but a natural reference point is to start from national accounts and how. Personal income is or national income is defined in national accounts, and fiscal income, the way Piketty Sayers defined it, was basically trending downwards as a share of national income. Less shows up on the individual income tax returns, less and less. So the alternative is to start with national income. So this is where the other Piketty Sayers and now Zucman paper comes in. So that paper allocates national income across the distribution, which now means so they look at individuals, not households, not tax units, but it now means that you have to allocate a lot of income that not reported on individual income tax returns. So a lot of income where you don't have direct information about who it corresponds to. So Piketty Sayers Zucman had another paper that does that, sort of revisits the methodology, addresses a lot of these issues, and still finds kind of similar patterns of inequality over time. So then this is where Otten and Splinter, this newest paper, comes in. It's not a new paper. It's now accepted and forthcoming or already published in the Journal of Political Economy. But the paper has been around for like 6 or 7 years, going through myriads of revisions and before it actually got published. And that paper basically revisits assumptions, both in the original Piketty Sayers paper and then in Piketty Sayers Zucman paper, and finds quite a different picture of inequality. So all we were talking about was pre-tax inequality.
Which has always fascinated me, because again, we mentioned like one of the big motivations for studying inequality would be to change your tax system. And like any change to the tax system won't directly affect the distribution of pre-tax earnings, because that would be after tax. And just like fascinating to me that you could have the most progressive tax system on earth and pre-tax earnings would only be like indirectly affected because of the, you know, some indirect, like
some method. Feedback loop, some or something. Feedback, yeah.
Some behavioral change.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. They are also doing after tax, which we can come back to. And there is, you know, separate literature on consumption inequality, which you could, ideally, probably that's the main type of thing that we would look at, like, you know, something about maybe lifetime consumption inequality. But like all of these things get increasingly hard to measure. Like, you don't have administrative data on consumption. You have only survey data.
Just for the sake of my father, who sometimes listens to this, I mean, when you talk about consumption, the idea there is it doesn't really matter how much you earn. What matters is how much do you have available to spend.
How much you actually did spend, because if you save it,
you did spend, not even available. You did spend.
Maybe like we don't care about that either. But how much you actually spent.
So if you can go to the grocery store and buy your food and whatever, then that's some measure of how much, I guess, income you had available. And so they're kind of correlated, but they're not exactly the same thing.
Now you can start thinking about, I don't know, a business that's illiquid and various other types of things that that would be happening where, you know, maybe by some definition you have income, but you cannot necessarily consume it. Or you can start thinking about distinctions between savers and spenders and all the other stuff. In any case, Otten and Splinter revisit Piketty-Sayers Zucman methodology, and also Piketty-Sayers methodology, make a lot of adjustments and find a much smaller growth in top incomes than those original papers have found. And if you look at after-tax inequality, they find even less.
So I'll just describe the graph. I'm looking at that paper right now, and it has a figure from 1960 to 2020, and the top 1% income share is on the y-axis going vertical, and the horizontal axis is the years. And the top 1% after-tax income share in this paper starts at about 8% in 1960, and it's about 8-point-something% in 2020. So it really hasn't changed. It just hovers around 8%.
That's surprising, given all the discussion about these issues, given everything that we've known from the previous papers, or we thought we've known from the previous papers. That's a very, 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 very big difference.
I do want to add something to that graph that Scott just described. It's not just that the after-tax income is basically a flat line at 8%, but what I love about this paper, and I am kind of a big fan of the paper, is that it starts with the fiscal income that is sloping up.
Like quite steeply. It goes from like 9% to 20% over that.
And just they make all these adjustments like, well, if you do something different with this, it goes down a little bit. Something else different goes down a little bit. Something else different goes down a bit. And you can just see how there's, you know, certain assumptions that were made that just like bring that line up. And if you just make the different assumptions, it gets flat. And then the question is, whose assumptions are best?
Yes, and there are a lot of assumptions that go into all of this. And I mean, we sort of touched on reasons why you need assumptions. So there are assumptions about unit of observation, but I guess it would be. I think it's simplest to think about it not as a comparison to the original Piketty-Sayers paper, but to this newer Piketty-Sayers Zucman paper. Because, when you do that comparison, like basically both papers try to allocate exactly the same thing. They allocate national income. They use the same unit of observation. They kind of agree on like how to deal with a lot of issues that were present in the old paper, and they still arrive at different answers. And I think what makes it actually, I'm sort of surprised that there's been so much newspaper coverage on this, because there isn't a smoking gun. It's not like there is one assumption that. That explains what the difference between the papers is.
Well, but to me, it's almost like if you had 10 different choices to make and just all of them made the line steeper, that's a little bit weird. It seemed like, you know, some assumptions you'd make would make the estimate bigger, some would be smaller, but for whatever reason, every assumption brings the line flatter.
So I agree. You still don't know which side made all the assumptions that you want to complain about. But that is one way, and actually maybe my preferred way of thinking about this. There are tons of assumptions that go into it on both sides, and we have something that maybe looks like bounds. The true line is somewhere in between. Even that may not be completely true, but at least it gives you, you know, the range of things that could be happening. And that's also, I mean, like what I dislike about this literature, like on a fundamental level, is that there are tons of assumptions that go into it. So obviously we are talking about something that we don't know and that's uncertain, but you don't have, you know, a confidence interval of any type on all of this. No, this is not sampling. It's really some forms of imputations or model errors, but there is a lot of uncertainty here. And when you read those papers, like maybe this is sometimes acknowledged. Definitely, when it's sort of presented to the public, it's no longer acknowledged. It's sort of here is the trend. Like here is the truth. Here is how the picture looks like. And like that notion that, like, you know, this is really all pretty uncertain is not there.
So, I mean, okay. So here's something I'm curious to just get your opinion about. When I look at the two lines, one is kind of flat, 8%. The other one is starting at, you know, 8 or 9% and increasing up to 20%. It feels like the policy implications of those two things are quite different. So, like, speak to what the policy implication would be if it was acknowledged that the trend was flat, as opposed to what the policy implications might be if it was acknowledged that the trend was, like, drastically increasing. What are the real world practical implications of those two things?
I mean, I don't think like that by itself, as a matter of, like, you know, for an economist, it immediately tells you what the implications are. But if you put some weight on equity, or if you think that there are some negative consequences that are associated with growing inequality, then, you know, obviously the sort of the stronger trend would suggest that you want to pursue some, you know, redistributive policies to a larger extent than otherwise. It's also, like, you know, in the background, there is often an argument made that these trends themselves are driven by changes in policy, that the U.S. system became less redistributive, and therefore you are seeing some of those things happening.
So, for example, that in 86, when we changed the tax code in 86, we see dramatically more income inequality because of the Reagan tax cuts in 86 would be an allegation. And so the policy thing, well, maybe we need to revisit TRA 86.
Because of base broadening, distributional neutral reform of Reagan.
I mean, so again, I think the assumptions are important, right? So you mentioned pre-tax versus after-tax is one of the assumptions, what you do with which you're counting.
Well, that's not an assumption. That's a kind of a different metrics that you can show.
And you get different results if you use after-tax versus pre-tax. Obviously, if we have a progressive tax system, things are going to look more equal if you use after-tax, if the tax system is indeed progressive.
This literature covers a lot about trends. So the fact that, if you look at the Otten and Splinter and pre-tax inequality that's still growing, but after-tax inequality that's fairly flat. The explanation is there is effectively more or transfer policy or a redistributive policy kind of offset what's happening with the pre-tax incomes.
Yeah, so if you looked at pre-tax, yeah, we have this big problem. They say, oh, we actually already solved it when we take into account the tax policy or the transfers that we've put in place, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to think about. And I think that's, you know, Jeff's point there is sort of interesting. Like, if we look at just the raw numbers before we think about the efforts that the government has already engaged in to solve the problem, it might give you a little bit of a different picture of where to go next. And I do kind of like looking at these different numbers in the Auten and Splinter paper. It's really interesting to see how things change when you just look at different numbers. And I agree with you. It is kind of hard to, as a consumer of this literature, to figure out exactly what is the, you know, right set of assumptions and what's exactly the right measure. And that's why I found it interesting that you were speaking about other things beyond just like income, because you can imagine people just throwing their arms up in the air and saying, we can't even measure this. There's just too many ways to do it. There's too many assumptions. Let's look at something entirely different, consumption, you know, and I guess you are looking for similar trends across different ways of thinking about it to try to hone in on what's actually happening in the world.
Yeah, I mean, yes, but consumption is tough. Like, we don't have good data on consumption. And especially once you start looking into the very top of the distribution, we really don't have very good data on this. Look, one thing that we didn't mention, in the income inequality literature, there is, like, you can still make distinctions that are sort of some relevance. You can think about labor or earnings versus capital incomes. So that's kind of also in the background of all of this. What exactly has been happening with labor and versus capital income inequality?
And is it true that even that literature, there's some dispute when they look at the labor share versus capital share? And some people say there's a big trend up, and some people say it depends on how you measure, and maybe there's not such a trend.
Yeah, there is controversy there, there are issues there that are actually closely related to measurement of income inequality. Something we didn't mention, there's another set of papers by Smith, Zadar, Zwick, and Danny Egan on one of them that also revisit questions related to income and wealth inequality with administrative data, but not necessarily doing the sort of full accounting, not necessarily doing the whole century. And in that context, I mean, you have to start thinking about, okay, how do we how can we observe business incomes? Are business incomes, especially nowadays, pass-through incomes, are there capital income or are there labor income? Like, if you look at a doctor's physician's practice, like, what are we looking at? Like, some of it is return to capital, some of it is return to labor, and so on. The way we can observe these types of incomes has changed over time, in particular because businesses changed their organizational form, and they are increasingly taxed since 1986 on individual income tax returns rather than corporate tax returns.
We have LLCs now, we have S-corps, we have, and there's all kinds of shenanigans that taxpayers play to make it look like their labor income, for example, is lower than their capital income, because capital income sometimes gets a lower tax rate than labor income, and you don't have to pay employment taxes. And in fact, I think Joe Biden has been scrutinized a little bit for his S-corp shenanigans, and John Edwards, who was a presidential candidate, had kind of a similar thing. And you can see, I love that point you're making, because even if you look at the data and you can see the data doesn't necessarily capture the underlying economics of what's happening. And that's a perfect example that's right. Very interesting to think about.
Right. So it turns out to matter in aggregate for the trends in labor versus.
And it would be easier to deal with if if there's errors, but those errors had been constant in time. But your point is just so interesting because the errors are changing over time, which could then be the cause of the trend that you're observing in the data.
Right, and if you think about these longer term trends, it's. Even the changes are not constant. So 1986 was a big event. So there is there are good reasons to think that things changed discreetly. But then, since then, there's been just kind of a trend toward organizing as pass-throughs rather than C corporations. And accounting, the big... discrete change, what you are looking at. When you think about... the smooth changes, smoother changes over time, that's very difficult to deal with.
Thank you so much, Wojciech, for your comments. Very interesting to hear. I know we just scratched the surface. There's so much to get into here, but I hope this will at least let the readers or the listeners understand that when they look at a headline that's related to income inequality, underlying that headline is a very vigorous academic debate that I do not believe is settled at this point. So we really appreciate your comments and helping us understand it.
Thank you. That was fun.
All right. I'm Scott Dyring and joined as always by my co-host and co-author, Jeff Hoops at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And our guest today has been Wojciech Kopczak, who's professor of economics at Columbia University. Thank you so much for listening. We'll chat with you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.